Hey, thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me up here. It's always a pleasure to come and visit. Okay, so what I'll talk about today is some work I've been doing over the last few years to try to study the binary black hole problem in general relativity. So here's a brief outline of the talk. I'll first give a motivation of why this is an interesting problem, just outside of, I think, what to me is just a fascinating theoretical problem, but in particular in terms of gravitational wave detectors and the promise of detecting gravitational waves in the near future. I will then briefly spend some time describing sort of motivating numerical relativity as a tool for the science of gravitational wave detection. In particular, why do we need to simulate binary black hole systems? I will then describe the numerical code that I've been working on. I won't go into too much details about the code. I'll spend some time talking about issues of the formalism. In particular, one thing I use is something called generalized harmonic coordinates. And I'll describe what that is and how it actually works in a numerical code. And then I'll describe some early simulation results, which is a merger of a close binary system. Okay, so brief overview of gravitational wave detectors. There's been a very strong effort in the last decade or so to actually try to build a network of detectors to detect gravitational wave emission from the universe. Here's a very pictorial view of the effort. Over here, I'm showing the LIGO-based, ground-based interferometers. That's the LIGO site in Livingston, in Louisiana. That's the site in Hanford, Washington. LIGO has a future planned space-based interferometer that will hopefully launch in 2013, and the various resonant bar detectors around the globe. And there are also efforts underway to try to observe various properties of the universe that might be sensitive to gravitational waves. For example, the pulsar timing network. People think that they might be able to time pulsars accurately enough in the next few years to be able to measure the effects of gravitational waves that pass between the pulsar and the Earth. Or, for example, looking at the effect that gravitational waves might make on the cosmic microwave background. So there's a very significant effort underway to try to detect gravitational waves, and one of the reasons is that it's expected that there are going to be a tremendous amount of sources that will tell us useful things about the universe. And so in this overview slide, just to give you an idea of at least what people hope to see with these gravitational wave detectors, I'm showing here on the vertical axis the source strength in sort of rough, no particular units, but just to give you an idea of the magnitude of the relative sources, and here the source frequencies. So at the sort of the strongest sources, we expect to be the merger of supermassive black hole systems, you know, 10 to the 6 solar masses or higher. And so that, in some sense, that's a motivation for why the relativity community is spending so much time, in particular the numerical relativity community, for studying these systems. Because they expect it to be one of the strongest sources of gravitational waves, and so one of the most promising objects or events that might be detected by the upcoming gravitational wave detectors. And sort of going down in source strength, but also increasing in frequency, you've got the slightly less massive black holes. And in particular the solar mass black holes, intermediate mass black holes, that it's still sort of an open question as to whether they might exist or not. But there's also a wealth of other events that could be detected. For instance, neutron star black hole mergers, binary neutron star systems. There might be, if there's enough asymmetry, for example, in pulsar births or deviations from oblate, just the standard oblate profile for pulsars, they might emit gravitational waves. Supernova might. Extreme ash-racer in spirals, we have a small compact object spiraling into a large black hole at the center of a galaxy. Neutron star binaries, white dwarf binaries. And then perhaps some of the most interesting physics is what I've called just exotic physics in the early universe. And right now, they're not very definite predictions for which of these events might actually exist in the early universe and might produce gravitational waves that are strong enough to detect. For example, cosmic strings, perhaps relics from the Big Bang or inflation. The reason I think that this is perhaps such an exciting area here is gravitational waves interact very weakly with matter. So there really is a possibility that we could actually see something using gravitational waves all the way back to a very short time after the Big Bang. And it's not, for example, like photons, where the strong interactions with matter essentially limit us to the surface of light scattering the cosmic microwave background. With gravitational waves, if these things exist and produce gravitational waves at a level that's strong enough, we could actually probe the very, very early universe. So just to summarize this plot again, I think there's a whole bunch of possible sources, some that we're not quite sure about, but if you look at the range of frequencies that these sources span, from 10 to the minus 12 and even lower to 10 to the 4 hertz, it's a tremendous range of fundamental physics that could be probed by observing gravitational waves. So now just switching to one of the sources, and those are binary black hole systems. To date, there's no, in some sense, conclusive or direct evidence that black holes exist, but there's a tremendous amount of circumstantial evidence that they do exist and that they play a very significant role in the evolution of our universe. In particular, there's very good evidence that most, if not all, galaxies host supermassive black holes at their centers. And also, so that's at the large mass range. At the small mass range, these current stellar evolution theory predicted a significant percentage of more massive stars are expected to end their lives and form smaller black holes. In particular, this is an image that I like very much. And this was called the smoking gun sort of evidence for the fact that there are supermassive black holes and that they merge. And the reason is that the current theory, one of the most successful theories describing jet structures that are seen emitted from the centers of galaxies, that there's a supermassive black hole at the center of the galaxy that's spinning very rapidly. It's got an accretion disk, a magnetized accretion disk, and somehow, and people don't quite know how yet, but somehow this system is able to then launch a jet perpendicular to the sort of parallel to the spin axis of the black hole. And so with a structure like this, what these jets imply, for example, so in this case, what's implied here is that there's a large black hole there that's spinning with a spin axis in this direction, so it's launching a jet in this direction. But because of this sort of this X-wing structure in the jet, what is inferred from this picture is that at some point in the past, if this theory that what's causing this jet is a supermassive black hole, something must have caused its spin axis to change dramatically. But pretty much the only thing that can do that is merge it with another large black hole. For example, accretion by a small object like a star is not going to be able to change the angular momentum of the black hole that rapidly. So this, what's apparently a very significant change in the spin axis, is consistent with a theory that, one, there's a black hole at the center being powered by an accretion disk, but at some point in the past, there was a merger of a binary black hole system. Okay, so I want to spend a little bit of time, just a couple of slides, sort of motivating going from, you know, why it's interesting to study black holes in the universe to perhaps why numerical relativity is useful for gravitational wave detection. And the big problem with these gravitational wave detectors is that for the majority of sources, we need to know something about what we're going to see before we can actually detect it. And the reason is that the gravitational wave strain is going to be much too small by the time it reaches Earth to actually produce a signal in the detector that you can just look at and immediately pick out. So some form of signal analysis is going to be necessary to actually infer that we've detected gravitational waves. And the primary tool that people are thinking about today is something called match filtering. And what match filtering does is you come up with a set of template waveforms or waveforms that you think, you predict what you think you're going to see, you fold that into the signal, you convolve it with a signal. And if actually there's such a signal exists, even if the signal to noise in the ratio is very low, by doing this convolution, you can really increase the effect of signal to noise. I just want to mention that this is not the only way that people are thinking of detecting gravitational waves. For example, if somehow we can come up with templates, there are methods that will tell us, yes, there is something there and it's probably a gravitational wave. I think if we can use match filtering, the problem is that we'll be able to extract less physics from the signal. So here's just a pictorial example of what I was saying, and this was images that I borrowed from Patrick Brady, and this is a couple of years old. And so what he did here was to demonstrate this match filtering idea is he took a simulated waveform from a binary black hole merger, and he assumed that these were equal mass black holes, 10 solar masses, at about 50 megaparsecs away. So that's about where the Virgo cluster is. And that's sort of the range where LIGO is, at least the initial LIGO where we hope to be able to see things if a binary black hole merger, if it occurs at that close. Sorry, this is a pretty bad image, but what it's showing is a so-called chirp waveform. So as the black holes orbit each other, they're emitting radiation, which means that they're losing energy. So they're spiraling, they slowly spiral in. So as they spiral in, the orbital frequency increases, so you can see that the frequency of the waveform increases, but also because they're going closer to the nonlinear regime, the gravitational radiation is becoming stronger, the amplitude increases. So this is the classic chirp waveform. And this was calculated using post-Newtonian techniques, and so this is the point where the post-Newtonian expansion breaks down. And so this is beyond, this is hopefully what we'll be filling in with numerical calculations. But in any case, for the purpose of this example, he took this simulated waveform and he took the actual the gravitational wave channel from one of the LIGO interferometers as of a year ago and injected it into the wave channel. So this actually contains this signal. But I mean, you can't see it, right? It's essentially completely buried in the noise. But because this is sort of a quasi-periodic signal, these match filtering techniques work well. And if you apply this match filtering algorithm using this template, you can actually pick out this event with a signal-to-noise ratio of 16. So, I've completely oversimplified the data analysis. I mean, they don't just do simple things. I mean, they've got several interferometers that they can make sure that they have coincident detections in all of them at the same time. I mean, it's a much more complicated business than I've alluded to here, but this is the basic idea behind match filtering, and so why we need to understand the signals to be able to make most out of the gravitational wave detectors. So again, as I've just said, to take full advantage of the promise of gravitational wave detection, we really have to understand general relativity in the regime where gravitational waves are produced. In other words, the highly nonlinear dynamical regime of the theory. And to date, if you think of like where the current knowledge comes from for astrophysically relevant solutions, it really stems together from patching together what we know about known stationary solutions, for example, the Kerr solution, perturbations about that, and some global properties of the field equations. For example, from the area theorem, and assuming cosmic censorship, we know that when black holes merge, it's going to grow. There's going to be a single larger black hole. It's not going to like shatter into millions of little black holes. So we know a lot about, in some sense, the general properties of what we expect, but we don't really have any solutions in the nonlinear regime. And at least as of today, I don't think perhaps the most promising way to actually uncover the theory is to try to solve the field equations numerically, which is what numerical relativity is about. Now, it might turn out that at the end of the day, for example, the post-Newtonian perturbative techniques can give a good enough waveform for the purpose of detection. But at least at this stage, we don't know. And if we don't know, we might be missing a lot. Maybe there might be a lot of surprises that we won't be able to, things that we'll just miss because we don't know what we're looking for. Okay, so now onto numerical relativity. I guess, as I've said before, what it really is just solving the Einstein field equations with computers. So this is the simple form of writing the Einstein equations in tensor form. That's the Einstein tensor. This is the stress energy tensor of the matter field. I'm using units where Newton's constant g and the speed of light c are set equal to 1. So, I mean, of course, it looks deceptively simple here, but this has turned out to be a very difficult problem to solve for a couple of reasons. I will just in two pages summarize this why I think it's been such a difficult problem and why it is, it's not a solved problem and it probably won't be for many decades still in all situations of interest. But the two main things, one is the mathematical difficulty of the equations. And if you actually expand the Einstein equations in a form which is amenable to solution on a computer, you get a system of 10 coupled nonlinear second order partial differential equations that depend on the four space-time coordinates. And of course, that's excluding any matter equations that you might want to solve. For example, if you want to solve with space-times with neutron stars, you've actually got to deal with the equations of state for the neutron stars. So first of all, it's a very complicated system of equations, but the problem is, if you just take those equations, throw them on a computer and like ask the computer to solve it, it can. I mean, in some sense, the system of equations is undetermined. And the character of the equation, there's no well-defined mathematical character such as elliptic or hyperbolic or parabolic. And so what you first have to do is you have to choose a gauge. And so now it was a sort of a manifestation of the covariance of the theory. You can't get a unique solution until you impose some kind of gauge condition. So in that sense, this system of equations is undetermined. But then once you do that, you look at the structure of equations, for example, in a typical Cauchy-type evolution where you want to specify initial data and then evolve with time. You find that four of the field equations only involve quantities that you would consider initial data. In other words, they're constraints amongst your variables. And so at the same time, the system of equations is overdetermined. There are more equations than unknowns. And so it's mathematically a very difficult system to actually get a handle on and come up with a scheme where we can actually get stable evolutions. But the other thing, I think, why it's been such a difficult problem is just that it's computationally a very expensive problem. So if you count, for example, how many flops, floating point operations, you would need to solve these equations in some kind of a numerical scheme, you typically need several thousand floating operations per grid point. So I'm thinking of some kind of a mesh, a discrete scheme where you solve these things on a discrete mesh of points. So you need several thousand operations per grid point. And then compounding that problem is for problems of physical interest, such as the binary black hole system, there are several orders of magnitude of relevant physical length scales that you need to resolve. And so, for example, with the binary black hole system, the smallest length is going to be the radius of each black hole. And then the next larger length of interest is the orbital radius. That sets sort of the scale for the waves that are emitted. But then you need the outer boundary sufficiently far away that you can measure the waves in the linear regime, because that's what the detectors are going to see at the end of the day. So even, for example, the binary black hole system, there are 2 to 3 orders of magnitude that you have to resolve. And so putting these things together, solving the Einstein equations in this for a general problem like this requires supercomputer-like resources. Okay, so now I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about the particular numerical scheme that I've been working on. This is just a one-slide overview. I'll spend some time talking about the formalism, the mathematical aspects of it. I'm not going to spend too much time talking about the numerics. I'll show you some examples of these things, but feel free afterwards to ask me about any details about the numerics. So the formalism is I don't actually solve the Einstein equations in the form that I wrote on the previous page. I use something called generalized harmonic coordinates. And I'll show in the next few slides exactly what they are and why they're useful in a numerical evolution scheme. One tricky thing about these generalized harmonic coordinates is how do you then choose a certain kind of slicing or gauge condition? For example, how do you choose your coordinate degrees of freedom? And I'll spend a couple of slides describing some of the ways that I've been trying to do that. Another thing that's been important has been adding so-called constraint damping terms to stabilize the evolution when they're black holes, and I'll explain exactly what that is. This is pretty much all I'm going to say about the numerics, except I'll show some animations and pictures, which will perhaps explain a few more things. But the numerical method, I use finite difference techniques. One interesting thing about this technique is that I directly discretize the metric. So the fundamental variables that I'm evolving are just the metric elements. In I think, essentially all other codes that people use today, they first convert, for example, a first order system. So they define additional variables which are particular gradients of the metric. That might be neither here nor there, but I think it's aesthetically sort of a pleasing way to do things, at least I think so. I use adaptive mesh refinement to be able to solve the many length scale problem. And I'll show you some examples of that later on. One problem with solving for black hole space sums numerically that there are singularities inside of black holes. These are geometric singularities, in other words, curvature singularities that you can't get rid of via coordinate transformations. And you can't simulate such infinities on a computer. So I use a technique called excision to deal with those singularities. Often in such finite difference codes, there are problems with high frequency modes. These aren't physical modes, but they come up, they sort of spurious numerical modes. And so one way to deal with them is to add something called numerical dissipation, which I do. Another interesting thing about this code is that I compactify the spatial infinity. And the only reason why I do it is to be able to place the physically correct outer boundaries on the computational domain. And I'll show you examples of the effects of this. So there's some disadvantages to doing that, but I think in terms of stability at the end of the day, it's turned out to work quite well. I'll talk about initialization. The way that I construct my binaries is through scalar field collapse. So it's sort of like a little trick way. But so I do solve the initial data, and I'll describe exactly how I do that. And there is, in general, going to be some initial radiation on the slice. But okay, so now to describe a little bit more generalized harmonic coordinates are. I mean, if you will, you can think of them as sort of like the Lorentz gauge condition in electromagnetism. It's a way that when you apply the condition, when you apply that gauge condition, the evolution equations for the metric become simple wave equations. And so explicitly the definition of harmonic coordinates would be that the wave operator operating on a space coordinate x mu, so this is the covariant derivative contraction over it. So this is just the sort of the box operator or the scalar wave operator acting on a space-time coordinate is zero. And this is just expanding that in terms of the metric. This is the metric, and this is the determinant of the metric. So generalized harmonic coordinates, instead of setting this thing equal to zero, you just add a set of arbitrary source functions. And as I mentioned before, like with the Lorentz gauge, the utility of doing something like this is, so when you take this condition, you promote these h to the status of independent functions. So you think of these now as being independent. And you substitute this condition, in particular its gradient, into the Einstein equations. What happens is that the principal part for each equation, for each metric element, reduces to a simple wave equation. I'll show you the full expression on the next slide. But in other words, what I mentioned before is if you just write out Einstein's equations without doing any kind of gauge fixing, the character of the equations are indeterminate. I mean, some terms look hyperbolic, some elliptic, some parabolic, so it's a complete mess. But doing this little trick, you actually convert it, at least from the point of view of the mathematics, to a system of hyperbolic equations. One thing I want to point out, by adding these source functions, you haven't really eliminated any fundamental coordinate degrees of freedom. Because you can see, just take any solution to the field equations in your favorite coordinate system and just plug it into this definition, and it will tell you what the corresponding source functions are. So in traditional harmonic coordinates, you do lose your coordinate degrees of freedom by setting that equal to zero. But in some sense, we're adding it back by adding these source functions.
The equation is symmetric?
The thing is, you have to, because you're now treating these as independent functions, you have to do something to specify them. And so if you think of them as just being just a function of the space-time, then it's symmetric hyperbolic. If you want to start adding equations for these things, then you have to look at the whole coupled system again. At least, the way that I'm solving the equations, I actually keep it in second-order form, and at least the symmetric hyperbolic, the formal definitions that I'm aware of, people first convert to, they convert to first order in space and time form. But I think standard ways of converting this to a first order time will be symmetric hyperbolic. So this is the full Einstein equations now. Again, that's the wave operator. These are some lower order nonlinear terms. Those are the source functions. This is the Christoffel symbol for the four metric. And then T is a stress energy tensor for whatever matter fields. And I'll be using scalar fields. And this is a trace of the stress tensor. So then the claim is that this system of equations is a solution to this system of equations is going to be a solution to the Einstein equations, provided you satisfy this harmonic constraint now. And this constraint is just taking the definition and subtracting h, so defining like box x minus h, that's got to be zero for any solution to the Einstein equations. So provided that constraint in its initial time derivative is zero. In some sense, the proof is the way that these constraints propagate. So if you like differentiate this expression and use a contracted Bianchi identity, you can come up with this evolution equation for the constraints. I don't actually solve this in the code, but in some sense, this is the analytical proof that solutions that initially have the constraints zero and the time derivatives of zero, it'll be zero for all time, because this is just a homogeneous wave equation. So ignoring issues of boundary conditions, so if you don't introduce any problems at the boundaries, a solution with C is zero initially, and the time derivative is initially zero for all time.
Superscript on the right is
actually supposed to be
negative.
Excuse me? Did I mess it up? Sorry about that. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that should be a contraction. Yeah, thanks for pointing that out. Okay, so the idea for actually having an evolution scheme that's directly based on this form of the Einstein equation was first proposed by David Garfinkel a few years ago. And Jeff Winokur and Bela Zalagi at Pittsburgh a little while later proposed something similar. And as far as I know, they worked on these things independently. But so the idea is to actually directly discretize the preceding set of equations. And perhaps just to sort of take a step back, I mean, this is actually a very different way of thinking about solving the Einstein equations as what people have done traditionally in numerical relativity. And what people have been doing is a so-called ADM, Arnoit, Deser, Misner decomposition of space-time, where instead of looking at the four metric, you decompose the four metric into a three metric, so a metric that's intrinsic to the particular spatial slice. We've got a lapse and a shift vector, which sort of encode how the normal observer moves normal to the slice, and then you've got an extrinsic curvature, which shows how that slice is embedded in the four-dimensional space-time. So you do sort of a space plus time decomposition. And I'll a couple of slides down will actually show you what that ADM decomposition is. But so that's the way that people have been solving the field equations, even in the symmetric hyperbolic form. And they rearrange things, but they always use those fundamental set of variables. So this idea was in some sense quite radical in proposing to actually use the four-dimensional metric and directly evolve that. So we're still evolving in time. We still have a notion of a space-like coordinate, a time-like coordinate, but we don't actually decompose the metric into spatial components and time-like components.
What are the usual constraints? I mean, you have those extra constraints in your harmonic coordinates, but the usual constraints, are they imposed?
In some sense, they've been turned into evolution equations. So if you think of it now, that we still have four fundamental constraints. They're the harmonic constraints now. If you look at what's happened to what you would normally think of the constraints, like the G00 components of the Einstein tension, the G0T components, they're now evolution equations. And so it's very strange that something that you think should be elliptic by nature is actually become hyperbolic. But it's a very strange thing that happens when you impose these conditions. So, but I don't think that's explained it very well. But the new constraints are only first order in the time derivative. So what now are constraints are those generalized harmonic coordinate conditions. So what I do at the initial time, it's not easy to solve those equations. So what I do is I actually solve the traditional York-style initial value problem. So I actually do an ADM decomposition at the initial time, solve those constraints, and then from there onwards propagate using the harmonic coordinates.
I presume you're going to
experimental. I think the problem was that I think on paper this looks like a great idea. I mean, just forget generalized harmonic, just harmonic coordinates, because you've got a system of wave equations. And that should be, like I say, I mean, the hope is then that it's going to be easy to solve using numerical techniques. I think the problem is that people, to some degree or another, experimented with harmonic coordinates and thought that it would be a problem because of coordinate singularities forming. That somehow these coordinates would go singular. For example, the application that David used was to look at the approach to the singularity in various cosmological type space-times. And he found that coordinate singularities developed. But the thing is, he only used pure harmonic coordinates. And so I think that there's been this impression in the community that harmonic coordinates are generically bad, or bad for the solution in generic space-times, because they're going to develop singularities. So even though they have these great mathematical properties, they're not going to be of use in the general space-time. And yeah, and so the thing that somehow that David didn't perhaps push as much as he should have. I mean, he proposed in the paper that yes, you can add these source functions that could then be used to perhaps avoid such singularities, but he actually never tried to do that with these cosmological simulations. And so the interesting thing is with the stuff that I've been doing, for example, with head-on black hole collisions, pure harmonic slicing seems to work perfectly well. And I think that if people had tried that in the past without just assuming that it's going to be bad because of the known problems with these sort of coordinate shocks and things forming, I think they might have seen that it could hold promise. And I mean, I can go into the details of it. So I do use a source function for the time component, but I'm not even convinced that's absolutely necessary, even in generic mergers. So it might be a pure harmonic coordinate. If you have initial data that's sort of adapted to the harmonic coordinates, should be fine. Like some people, for example, have also looked at cases where with harmonic evolution, coordinate shocks develop, but I think that's an artifact of bad initial data. So, right, because because it looked promising, and there was that the loophole that no one had played with source functions yet. So there was a thing that even if I did run into problems, there might be a way to cure it. And the other thing is that there's so many other people doing things in traditional ways. Sometimes it helps to look things. They take a slightly different point of view.
Does efficacy in the end depend on a clever choice of these HMU?
I don't think it's a very clever choice. I'll explain exactly what I used, and it wasn't based on any deep insights. And I suspect that basically because head-on collisions work without. The thing with head-on collisions, in my code, the effect, if you look at the effective lapse function, when a black hole forms and the lapse becomes small, my code becomes unstable. It's got a tendency to be unstable, and I think that's just a numerical problem. Because when I add sufficient resolution, I can always evolve to a smaller value of the lapse. And so with head-on collisions, it's in axisymmetry, I can add a lot of resolution. So in situations where I've seen this problem develop and the code has crashed when the black holes are very close to each other, but I haven't detected a common horizon, I've been able to cure it in axisymmetry by just adding more resolution, because then I can evolve them a little bit closer. I eventually detect the encompassing horizon, I excise the problem region, and things are fine in pure harmonic. The thing is, in 3D, when the holes get closer, I see the same kind of problems developing, but I can add more resolution. It's just computationally too expensive. So what I've been doing with this source function is sort of a trick to try to keep the effective lapse from going that small. So, I mean, it might be that it is essential in 3D because it is a dynamically very different situation, but it might just be that it's also a resolution issue. This is sort of like a trick to be able to get past some numerical problems. Okay, so talking about the coordinate issues, The tricky thing now becomes, and so we've added these source functions, but the question now becomes, okay, well, what do they represent? I mean, is there some way to think of them in a geometric fashion? Because it's easy to say, take some solution in a given coordinate system and calculate the source functions. But if we now want to evolve in time, we don't know what the space-time is going to be. In some sense, how do we choose an equation that will evolve these source functions in a way that will give a well-behaved slice? The thing that you have to be careful of, if you specify an evolution equation, you want to make sure that you don't mess up the hyperbolicity of the coupled system of equations. I don't have a very good answer to this question. I mean, what I eventually had to do was appeal to the ADM decomposition to give some kind of an insight into what these source functions represent. So this is the standard ADM decomposition of the four-dimensional metric. So instead of ds squared being g alpha beta dx alpha dx beta, you split it up into a spatial metric, the lapse function and the shift vector. And so taking this form of the metric and sort of decomposing the source function in terms of a spatial and a temporal component. So taking this the source vector and
taking the inner product with this n is the hypersurface normal vector. So the time-like vector that's normal to a t equals constant hypersurface, you get this expression. This is a trace of the extrinsic curvature of the three metric. And similarly, if you take the spatial projection of the source function, you get this expression. And this is the Christoffel symbol for the three metric. So looking at these expressions, it turns out that the only time derivative here, in some sense, for the temporal component of the source function, is the time derivative of the lapse. And similarly, the only time derivative that appears in this entire expression is a time derivative for the shift vector. So sort of rewriting it in this form, you can see that one way of thinking of what these source functions do is that they drive various, they can be used to drive the lapse and the shift. Thinking of the slicing in terms of the ADM variables. And a lot of work has been done over the last 30 years to come up with sort of very geometric, sort of intuitive slicing conditions or slicings in terms of these laps and the shift. For example, if you set the source functions equals to zero, you get evolution equations that will tell you how the laps and the shift evolve in harmonic coordinates. But if you want to have some kind of a slicing that evolves to a particular value for the laps and the shift, for example, maximal slicing is a common thing. A common slicing that people use, and that with maximal slicing you solve for the lapse function. Say you want to evolve towards a maximal slice. With this kind of equation, it tells you like what kind of source function you need that will drive the lapse to a given value. So to get a bit more explicit, like what I mentioned before, like the problem that I was having with the lapse collapsing to zero. So one of the properties of just temporal harmonic slicing in a gravitational collapse scenario is called singularity voiding. So as a slice evolves towards a singularity, what happens is that the lapse function tends to go to zero. And so the lapse sort of tells how time is evolving for an observer that's normal to the slice. And so what that effectively means is that the evolution freezes as you approach a singularity. But as I said before, in my code, when the lapse becomes too small, there seem to be problems. And I think it's just a numerical thing. There's nothing physically wrong with that. And so the first set of conditions that I tried, this was actually in a scalar field collapse scenario. I wasn't actually looking at binaries at the time. Was to choose these source functions to try to keep the lapse from collapsing as fast as possible. And so these are just a set of three different expressions. This is just an algebraic expression of the source function in terms of the lapse. This is a first order in time, this is like a wave type equation. But they're all designed to do the same thing. The xc's and n's and zeta are just constants to control how fast it works. But the easiest way to see how this works is just to look at this first expression. So the nominal value of the lapse is 1, which is the value at infinity on the typical kinds of coordinates that we use. So you can see if the lapse is greater than 1, this is positive. And so if you go back to showing how the source function evolves, you'll see this will have a term that sort of drives it back to 1. The time derivative is negative here. And similarly, if the lapse is less than 1, this expression will be negative. And then, of course, if you see how it's going to change the time derivative of the lapse, it's actually positive. So these conditions are, you specify the source function using these conditions, and we'll try to keep the lapse closer to unity. So again, it's like not a very clever coordinate condition. It's kind of naive, but it seemed to help a lot with those kinds of problems.
Do you need the lambda bigger than 2?
Excuse me?
Do you need the lambda bigger than 2?
Yeah. So I use n equals 5. And I don't need to really fine-tune these parameters. You just have to make them large enough that they have a significant effect in the evolution. But yeah, so I think n has to be bigger than 2. Let's see, I wanted to say something else. The one comment I just wanted to make is, again, in the evolution scheme, alpha is not an independent function. I actually just substitute what alpha is as a function of the metric elements. But it's a very useful diagnostic quantity, and I'll show you an animation of alpha with a binary black hole problem. And it's really sort of a nice way of actually thinking about the slicing. Okay, so before I show that, I just want to spend a couple of slides talking about constraint damping. So one problem that that plagues many numerical codes, these so-called free evolution codes, where they try to write the Einstein equation in hyperbolic form and then evolve them in time, is so-called constraint violations. And remember, there are constraints that have to be satisfied for any analytic solution to the Einstein equations. Even if you solve the evolution equations, the constraints will be satisfied for all time if they're satisfied at the initial time. But of course, numerically, that's not going to happen. They're only satisfied within truncation error. But often what happens is, if there's a little violation of the constraints, in some sense, the code is unstable. It's not a numerical instability. It's a property of the system of equations, and you get exponential growth of those constraints. So with the harmonic coordinates, everything seems to be fine until you start adding black holes. So the constraints, I showed you that propagation equation for the constraints, that wave equation. And if there aren't black holes, that just seems to be what happens. There's no exponential growth. If there are constraints, they just propagate away. But as soon as black holes start forming, it seems that those waves sort of hang around the black hole and they grow in time, and eventually they cause the equation, the code to crash. So a few months ago, Karsten Gundlach was visiting Caltech, and he suggested adding some terms to the equations to try to cure this. So he was working with a form of the field equations called the Z4 formalism, which is very similar to harmonic. And so he was trying this with the Z4 formalism, and because of the similarities, he suggested I try it. And so what you do here is, this is just the Einstein equations, the dots represent all the other terms, and you just add some function which is zero for any solution to the Einstein equation. So you're not changing the set of solutions that you're going to be getting if you satisfy these constraints. But in some sense, you're changing the structure of the way that the constraints propagate. You're not changing the principal parts of the equation, so the lower order terms. At least for the Z4 formalism, what Karsten was able to show is that if you have small perturbations about flat space-times, and if these perturbations violate the constraints, so if there's a non-zero C, which is unphysical, if you still evolve that system of equations, because you've added these terms, all of those C's will be exponentially damped to zero. I think it'll be very difficult or perhaps impossible to show that it does it in general, but at least in perturbations about fast space, that's what adding these terms seems to do. And so I tried it with my code, and it seemed to help a lot with the black holes. I'll show you on the next slide. Oh, by the... Sorry? No, the H's are in some sense the gauge conditions, right? So I've got box X equals H. So then just box X minus H is a zero. That's identically zero for any solution to the field equations. So now what I'm doing is I'm just saying, in general, let's assume that they, for whatever reason, they might not be zero. For example, in a numerical scheme, this condition is only going to be approximately satisfied. So in some sense, if you will, these are the gauge conditions. But this expression is an identity in some sense for solutions to the Einstein equations, and so I'm calling it a constraint now. I don't know if I've explained that properly or...
I'm slightly confused about how it relates to the other program where people are taking P plus one, and then they're writing down the equations and
the multiples,
the old-fashioned experiences.
Yeah, so that's the same idea. I mean, for whatever reason, for those systems, adding multiple of the constraints have helped, but it hasn't actually cured the problem. So, for example, the standard ADM form of the equations where you don't add any multiple of the constraints, it's only weakly hyperbolic, and so people... there's good reasons to expect that things won't work. So people in those cases have been able to add multiples of the usual Hamiltonian momentum constraints to make it strongly or symmetric hyperbolic. And so I guess the nice properties of those equations then can be exploited, but it still turned out that they have constraint violating modes. That adding multiples of the constraints in those situations didn't actually help in terms of long-term evolution. In this case, the equations are already hyperbolic. And the nice thing is that adding these constraints doesn't affect the principal parts. So the way that people traditionally add them is it actually does, and that's why they added them, to change the structure of the principal parts. So here we're not changing the principal parts of the equation, but doing it in such a way that, go back. So without adding those terms, this is the way that the constraints would propagate analytically if you had a non-zero C. So doing that change, you get a whole bunch of extra terms. But one of the terms looks like a term you'd expect in a damped wave equation. It's proportional to the time derivative, if you will, of the C's. The other terms, it's difficult to see how they would behave, but at least there is a term that acts like a damping term. And so you can see that analytically, the way that the constraints propagate for those terms is like a damped wave equation, at least in certain situations. For example, in the perturbations around flat space. Okay, here's just an example to show you the drastic effect on the constraints that adding that term has to the equation. So here I'm going to show you the constraints for the evolution of just a Schwarzschild black hole in axisymmetry. All these boxes is just an artifact of the visualization. I use adaptive mesh refinement, so the resolution is increasing toward the small boxes, but I haven't cleaned up the picture. There's the black hole. This is the axis of symmetry. So if you will, cylindrical coordinates, this is the z coordinate, this is the rho coordinate. On the simulation to the right, I've got a constrained damping parameter that's just 1 over 2m. And so the nice thing about this constrained damping thing is it's not very sensitive to that parameter. You just have to choose one that's sufficiently large that those terms are relevant in the equations. And here, in some sense, the smallest or the highest relevant frequency is just 1 over the mass, and so setting it to 1 over the mass is sort of a reasonable choice. On the left-hand panel, I've just got the original system without any constrained damping. So I'll play it once, and you'll see. So the one on the left is going to crash very quickly. But I'll play it again. But what you could see is that on the left, initially there's some wave-like motion in the constraints, which is what you expect. They propagate like a wave equation. But in the vicinity of the black hole, the amplitude of these waves are actually growing, and eventually it causes it to crash. But on the right-hand side, because of these terms, there's almost no evolution. It sort of immediately settles down to something which is proportional to truncation error. Let me play it again. So you can see the wave-like nature, but the waves grow with time. So both of these... both of these cases are technically stable and convergent from a numerical point of view. And this is sort of a graph that demonstrates that. But the problem is that to suppress those, to get those modes for the simulation without constrained dampings at a level that's sufficiently small, that they don't grow to the point for the effective simulation, for the length of the simulation, you need excessively high resolution. So what these constrained damping terms allow one to do is to get away with, in some sense, reasonable resolution.
So the stripes coming out, those are just artifacts?
Yeah, in particular, like what I'm doing is, actually with these, what I'm plotting here is a sum of all of the Einstein constraints, the entire Einstein equation. And it's sort of a local pointwise L2 norm. So any one of them is going to have some kind of a, like with this axisymmetric spacetime, like a quadrupole type structure. But because I'm like taking an L2 norm over all of them, you get these little peaks and valleys. So it's sort of a numerical artifact. And the actual scale here isn't very relevant either. It's just, yeah. Okay, so now before I show some of the simulations I do, I'm just going to give a very brief and, as I said, incomplete history of the binary black hole problem in numerical relativity. Just sort of give you a flavor of where things have been going. So the first simulations of a binary black hole system was by Larry Smorey in 1977 for his PhD thesis. This was actually a phenomenal calculation. I mean, it's an axisymmetric one because it's a head-on collision. But if you think in 1977, the kind of computers that they had, the fact that he was actually able to do it was very remarkable. In fact, it was such a challenging problem that no one really explored this in any more detail until the early 90s again. I think people again started looking at it in the 90s, first because the computers were a bit more powerful, but then also because of the fact that LIGO was seemed like it was going to be a reality, and so there was a real push to try to understand the waves generated by these things. So the effort really started up again in the early 90s. And first people looked at the head-on collision case in more detail, and then they started working on the 3D problem. And the first sort of grazing collision simulation was done by Bernd Brugmann about five, six years ago. And I'm showing you to the evolution up to 20 M. So M is a very useful unit of time in these black hole simulations. So because I'm using sort of geometric units, it's sort of the relevant of order unity type measure to describe these things. So for instance, a typical orbital time scale very near the end might be on the order of 100 to 200 M. So this was a grazing collision where they were slightly off axis. It ran to about 20 M before it crashed. One of the more recent breakthroughs was again by Burns' group. They were able to get a full orbit of a quasi-circular binary, and the evolution lasted for till about 280 M. So these were actually reasonably far apart, and they ran for an orbit before the simulation crashed. And similarly, the Miguel Alcubierre collaborators, so this is formerly Ed's group at the AEI, and also some people that moved with him to LSU, and they were able to get a similar kind of evolution for their codes. The difference in this one was that they tried to get the same circular orbit, but because their black holes were much closer together, they actually plunged very quickly. But then this simulation also crashed shortly after a common horizon was detected. So what I'll show you now is, in some sense, it's about the same length of time that I can get, but the code seems to be stable in the sense that it doesn't crash after. There doesn't seem to be any. The only problem is that at a given finite resolution, numerical errors accumulate, and so at some point the results become garbage. But it doesn't seem as if there's any fundamental convergence problems with this code. So, very brief overview of the initial data. Again, at this stage, I'm not too interested to try to reproduce some system that's of relevance to astrophysics. First of all, because it's that's going to be a very challenging problem in terms of the runtime. I don't have the computer resources to do it. But also, I want to try to understand what's actually happening qualitatively in general relativity with binary space-time. Like, are there any surprises or any interesting things to do? So I want to set up a situation where I can evolve to simulate some orbital motion. I can evolve through the merger regime where you've got a highly distorted Kerr black hole and the ring down phase where it's emitting the gravitational waves, and try to measure the waves in infinity. So I want to explore all of those regions for some binary system, not necessarily a particular binary. And so the way that I can do that very easily is to use boosted scalar field collapse. In other words, in my initial data, I don't start with black holes. I start with two very dense clumps of scalar field energy and give them boosts. Very shortly after the initial time, they collapse to form black holes. The remnant scalar field that's left in the space-time essentially leaves the system on the order of a light crossing time, and you're left with a binary black hole system. So the disadvantage to such approach is that, in some sense, after you've done this kind of setup, you've specified your boost parameters, and you can sort of guess what they might have to be for a particular orbit. But it's not such as... It's usually because not all of the energy goes into the black hole. That's not the orbit that you'll get at the end of the day. So yeah, you in some sense have to fine-tune your parameters to get a particular orbit at the end of the day. But at least at this stage, the convenient thing about it is that there's no singularity in the initial slice. So it's a very well-behaved initial value problem. And another nice thing is that all of the non-trivial geometry is just driven by the scalar field. I don't have to worry about specifying the radiation constants of the space-time. I mean, there is going to be, because of the nonlinearity of the equation, there will be some other gravitational radiation in the space-time, but at least from the point of view of controlling the initial data, it's just a single function. And these are some of the details of the initial data, and I won't go into that, but if someone is interested, I can talk about that. So just the particular gauge conditions I use, again, I use this driver type condition to keep the labs from collapsing as rapidly. And I use the wave equation form just sort of for aesthetic reasons. So now the entire system is just a system of wave equations. 10 wave equations for the metric, one for this and one for the scalar field. The spatial source functions I set to zero, so in some sense it's spatially harmonic. So just a little caveat is that in the textbook, when the textbooks classify the sort of contravariant components as being harmonic, so I'm setting the covariant spatial components to zero. So it's not strictly speaking spatial harmonic in what people in the way that people usually think of it, but I think it's sort of morally equivalent. Again, with these parameters, they're not, you don't have to fine-tune them or the constrained ending parameter, but they just, you have to choose values that are sufficiently large that it's relevant. Okay, so this is the most recent simulation that I've been running. It's initial data. So what I'm showing here is the positions of the center of the apparent horizon for the binary. So I'm starting them at y equals 0. So this is the z equals 0, the slice through the orbital plane of the simulation. If I start the two scalar field distributions at y equals 0, I boost them in this direction. And you can see very shortly afterwards, black holes form. In other words, apparent horizons. So I detect apparent horizons, and then I start excising inside of the apparent horizon to remove the geometric singularity. And so what I'm plotting here is the center of the apparent horizon as a function of time for simulations with three different resolutions. But that actually, the high resolution simulation is still running. It's still about there. It hasn't quite yet detected the final apparent horizon. So what happens is these black holes spiral in, and at this point, a single encompassing apparent horizon is detected. And so I start excising about that one and ignore the individual horizons.
Roughly, what's the shape of the apparent horizon?
So, yeah, so in the next show, I'll show an animation which will give you an idea of it, but initially they're quite spherical. As they start approaching each other, they distort and they become elliptical. In some sense, they stretch out and point towards where the other black hole was, in the light crossing time away. And when the black hole first forms, it's initially almost peanut shaped. It sort of like encompasses the two. But it very quickly settles down to a Kerr black hole, like a Kerr shape. I'm sorry, I did at one point have animations of the apparent horizon, but I forgot to make it for this one. So, but you can sort of infer the shapes from the animations for the labs. This is in the simulation coordinates, and just for reference, this is what the orbit looks like in sort of the reduced mass frame. So this is the position of one black hole relative to the other one. These black holes are sufficiently close together, so 13m in coordinate distance, 16m in proper distance on the initial slice, that it doesn't really make sense to say that it started from an orbit with a given eccentricity, but just for sort of comparison's sake, I've plotted out what orbits of circular orbit, eccentricities of 0.1 and 0.2 would look like. And so you can perhaps say that by matching the first part of the orbit where there hasn't been too much radiation reaction yet, this could be an orbit with an eccentricity initially of somewhere between 0 and 0.2, but then it very quickly spirals in. In this case, the black holes initially have no spin, but when the final Kerr black hole forms, the Kerr parameter is about 0.75. The final mass of the black hole, and I'm counting mass here in terms of the area of the apparent horizon, is about 1.85 times the mass of each initial black hole. So the little m that I use is the mass of the initial black hole. And so I think a significant portion of this is due to radiation, gravitational radiation. I mean, I'm guessing that the error is about 5%, but it's going to take some, I'm going to have to do more simulations to actually get a firmer indication of how much is actually emitted by gravitational radiation by looking at the difference in the mass. But I'll show you a plot of radiation later, but that's even less accurate calculation. So in this animation, I'm showing the lapse function on the orbital plane. So initially, it's almost one everywhere. And you'll see what happens is very quickly, you'll see two black holes form. The lapse will collapse down. I think it gets to, the minimum is about 0.3, but in this animation, the color range goes from 0.5 to 0.1. You see they orbit around, eventually a single black hole forms, and it settles down to a Kerr black hole. So what, at a little bit after the merger, it looked like the apparent horizon jumped. But so what I'm actually showing here, this black region is the excision surface. So the apparent horizon is actually some distance outside the excision surface. And what I'd like is to have a pretty large buffer zone between the apparent horizon and the excision surface. So the reason why you can do this excision is because the event horizon is supposed to be outside the apparent horizon, and so anything that happens inside the event horizon cannot causally influence what happens outside, and that's sort of the justification for why we can excise the singularity. Now numerically, of course, that's going to hold, but only to within truncation error. So in some sense, if you're very close, if the excision surface is very close to the apparent horizon, there's not much of a buffer zone. And so there could be some sort of signals propagating outside. So just sort of for safety's sake, I like to keep the excision surface as far inside the apparent horizon as possible. But very close to the merger, I can do that. If I try to keep the excision surface too close in, then it crashes. The singularities develop outside, and I think they're just coordinate singularities. I don't think the physical singularity is appearing there yet. So I have to sort of make the apparent horizon, so the excision surface quite close to the apparent horizon. But then once it settles down to what's more like a stationary situation, then I increase the size of the buffer zone again. So it's not really a jump in the apparent horizon, it's just the buffer zone. But I'll play this again, and if you look closer, you can see it's initially spherical. They become somewhat distorted there, and then the final black hole is quite distorted, but it rings down relatively quickly to a curved black hole. Okay, so a couple of animations of the scalar field. So in this plot, it gets again the z equals zero slice. I'm taking the scalar field, multiply it by r, and I'm showing it as a surface plot. So the magnitude, the height of the surface, is also a representation of the magnitude of the scalar field. So let me show. And I'm showing this in uncompactified coordinates. So the thing that I want to show here is, even in other ways of producing initial data. So there still is a real big problem in general relativity of producing astrophysically realistic initial data. So what you'd really need is, when the black holes are at some distance when you're going to start your simulation, the initial radiation content of the space-time should be the prior in-spiral history of these black holes. So it should contain the wave train that's being emitted by the system. But of course, no initial data, even this stuff, has that. And so people are worried, well, okay, one way you think of perhaps sweeping that problem under the rug is orbiting this thing for a few orbital periods. And so that in some sense, the junk radiation flushes out, and you're left with, you have to throw away the first few orbits of the simulation. But at least what this is showing, if the scalar field is any kind of judge, is that you probably don't have to wait very long for that. I mean, the scalar field isn't leaving the system on the time scale of an orbital time scale. It's leaving it on the light crossing time scale, which is much, much shorter. So you'll see again that pretty much by this point, there's gravitationally no scalar field left. It very quickly falls into the black hole, and the part that doesn't radiates away very, very rapidly. Just to demonstrate the spatial compactification, now this is the same data, but now I'm showing it in the actual code coordinates. And this is the compactification scheme that I'm using. It's very, very simple. So this outer boundary is actually spatial infinity. So this highlights a couple of the difficulties with using this kind of compactification scheme. So you can see that it's just, these should be spherical wavefronts that go out. And because I've multiplied it by r, they shouldn't decay with time. So the fact that they become square, that's just a coordinate effect, which isn't a problem. But the fact that the amplitudes are decreasing is because with this compactification, the waves also get blue shifted. But the grid resolution out here is very poor. So you're getting this wavelength which is not represented well on the grid. And so the numerical dissipation essentially kills the wave, which is in some sense a positive thing for something like the scalar field, which I don't really care about after it's formed the black holes. But for measuring gravitational waves, where you really want to be as far as possible for measuring it, it actually can be a bit of a problem. So just to demonstrate the nature of the grid in the next few slides, we'll just first describe it. So this is the only bit where I'll tell you about the numerics. So with that particular simulation, I use something called adaptive measure refinement. I'll show you on the next slides what that is. The base grid had a resolution of 33 cubed. I had 9 levels of 2-to-1 refinement. At least early on, like after the final black hole formed, I switched to 8 levels because I didn't really need 9 levels to represent the final black hole. It took about 50,000 time steps on the finest level, and in total about 26,000 CPU hours. So that this sort of demonstrates in the 10 gigabytes memory, 100 gigabytes of disk space. So this is really a very intensive problem. And this is the medium resolution one. So like in finite difference, ideally for the next higher resolution, you'd want to double the resolution, but that will take 16 times as long. So this is like a few weeks. 16 times is a few months, which is too long to wait. So what I do when I go to the next higher resolution, I don't allow it to increase the resolution all over the place. I sort of just sort of pick and choose where I allow it to refine to make it manageable, but it's still a very intense problem. This is an example of the mesh structure, the adaptive mesh refinement. There's one snapshot of the scalar field on the orbital plane. So you can see this is the resolution near the outer boundary. And in the next few frames, I'm just going to zoom in on the position of one black hole. And we can just see how as the physical length scales become, the relevant length scales become smaller. In other words, around the black hole, it adds finer resolution grids to properly resolve it. Okay, so the final topic, I'll just take a few slides and a few animations, is the question of waveform extraction. So there's a question now, can we actually extract a waveform given that there's unphysical radiation in the initial data? Is that going to mess things up for a long period of time? I mean, this particular code, one of the questions is compactification. Do we have to put the outer boundary so far away that it's going to be in that coarse region where we can't get a very accurate waveform? And what about something I'm calling AMR noise? Like often at mesh interfaces, the interface between a fine and a coarse grid, there tend to be reflections and things. And these things do converge away, they're not physical. But the particular resolutions that we can actually practically solve for, these things might be a problem. And even though at this stage, I mean, it seems like it's not an insurmountable problem, but of course the caveat is how accurately do you want the waveform? But at least I think these aren't going to be showstoppers. So what I've got now, at least at this stage, as a measure of the radiation, is the Newman-Pendo scalar Psi-4, which, if you're sufficiently far from the source, should represent the gravitational waves that are outgoing. So what I'm showing here is Psi-4 times R, again, to try to cancel the 1 over R type falloff on the orbital plane of the simulation. So what you'll see is initially there'll be a whole lot of crap. Some of it you can actually trace to the scalar field, so the very short wavelength, wave-like features. You'll see a lot of stuff that you can actually see is coming from mesh refinement, reflections and things, but at late times, a pretty nice waveform emerges. Where's the pointer? So you can see a lot of junk initially. At this point they've merged, but now you get a very nice ring down signal coming from the black hole. The first part of it actually is the orbital motion, and what you see mostly afterwards is the ring down. And then at late times, so this is the fact that this sort of kind of the pattern where the amplitude is higher there and there, that's an artifact of the grid. So that's finite resolution effects and the compactification. But I'll show you, let's play this again. You can see some, this is like associated with a scalar field pulse. This is actually some orbital waveform, and this is mostly the ring down waveform. So at least with this kind of simulation, it seems practical that perhaps at this distance you might be able to get a decent waveform. Except the problem is this is going to be close enough that nonlinear effects, I think, could still, they're not going to be dominant, but they could still be important. There's a couple of other animations. Now I want to show the real component in the sort of orthogonal to the orbital plane. So this thing is just a visualization artifact. So with these equal mass non-spinning black holes in the orbital plane, there's only a non-zero real component, and that sort of corresponds to the plus polarization of the gravitational waves. Specifically, I think the second time derivative of the plus polarization at a point is equal to the real component of Psi-4. Now along the sort of tangent to the orbital plane, you can have both a real and an imaginary components, and they correspond to the plus and the cross polarization. So just sort of a visualization of what that actually is. So again, initially there's some junk. And then for the plus polarization, or the second time of the plus polarization, you get this kind of a pattern. And just to contrast, then the imaginary component is related to the cross polarization, and it's got the sort of the, you can see here on this is the orbital plane. It's actually zero on the orbital plane. That's just because of the symmetry of the situation. And here, so I've just picked some location away from the binary. This is actually at several distances, at theta equals pi by 2, at phi equals 0, and just plotted the waveform. And what I've done here is I've taken to show like what does the waveform look like at various radii. And so if this is in the linear regime, what would happen is, so I'm taking it and I'm shifting it in time. And if it now were in the linear regime where it's actually traveling outwards at the speed of light, because the radii are 25 m apart, I should just have to shift it in time by 25 m if it's traveling at the speed of light. So you can see here, because I have to shift it first by 30 m to align it up. So I visually just lined up the peaks. It's not quite in the linear regime yet. From 25 to 50 m, I had to shift it by 30, then by 28, then by 27. So you can see as you're going further out, you are approaching the linear regime. But another thing to notice is that the further you go out, the smaller the amplitude. And I think that's mostly because of the dissipation. So this wave is moving into a region of the grid which is poorly resolved, and the energy is being dissipated away. And at this stage, so using Psi4 to calculate the energy that's radiated, and this is sort of the expression that you use, if you're sufficiently far away from the source, you integrate this quantity P, which is sort of like the square of Psi4. This is right, I think, a very inaccurate way to calculate it numerically. Excuse me. And one reason is because of sort of the memory effect here. You can see that you're taking in to get this quantity P, which you're then going to integrate over the sphere. That's representing the rate of change of energy at a particular time. And to get P, you're integrating all the way from the initial time to the ending, to that particular final time. So in other words, this P is a very special function. If you think of it, say you've got whatever gravity system that's radiating in the center, it radiates for a while and then it stops radiating. And if you're measuring this function P a distance away from the center, this integral from the initial time to when T is past the point where it's radiating should always integrate to zero. Because after the radiation has passed, the E dt should be zero. But of course, numerically, when you integrate this, there's going to be some error terms. And in general, they aren't going to integrate to zero. And so they continue to accumulate. For example, if you kept on integrating this, eventually you'll get infinite energy radiated just from the inaccuracy of the numerical calculation. So take these numbers with an extreme amount of salt, because they are inaccurate. They're in general going to estimate it. So I've just plugged the results in and get somewhere from 7 to 19% of the total rest mass energy being radiated. And because of this memory effect, I think this is quite an overestimate. To get some other rough, perhaps more conservative estimates, remember that initially I showed you that the final horizon mass was 1.85 times the initial mass of an individual black hole. So that suggests that perhaps 7.5% is radiated. And another sort of test that I did to make sure that the code wasn't completely giving the wrong answers was I did do exactly the same numerical parameters. Instead of boosting them orthogonal to each other, I boosted them towards each other. So a boosted head-on collision. And those results have been calculated in the literature before. And people find that in that case, about 0.1% of the rest mass is radiated. So what happened is I took that simulation with essentially the same resolution and found that the amplitude of the wave was about 1/7, the amplitude of the merger simulation. Because the energy is proportional to the amplitude squared, it's about a factor of 50 difference. So just taking that order of magnitude estimate, you'd think that this would be perhaps 5% of the energy radiated. So perhaps the conservative estimate is that 5% is radiated in this final plunge ring down phase. You can see these are quite overestimates. Even in the further you go away, the dissipation is reducing the amplitude, and so I think this is mostly the dissipation's fault. But it's still, so I'm going to have to do a lot more work. and perhaps use some other techniques to extract the radiation in the end. So before I conclude, just a sort of a page of fun order of magnitude fact. So, okay, what does this wave actually represent? I mean, if you're sitting near the black hole and felt this wave pass or try to look at it, what would it represent? So let's scale the system up to something that LIGO would be able to see, in other words, 10 solar masses or so. In that case, the radius of each of those initial black holes was about 30 kilometers, and the radius of the final black hole about 55 kilometers. And for example, if the 50m extraction surface is a distance of 750 kilometers from the black hole then. So you can imagine these black holes merging, I don't know, perhaps somewhere in Northern California. and so in that case, you'd have this wave, that little oscillatory wave pass, you had a frequency of about 600 Hertz. So in just a fraction of a second, that ring down wave would pass you. The fractional distortion in space-time induced by this wave is about 10 to the minus 3. And so if you're 2 meters tall and you're standing there, this wave will stretch you by about 6 millimeters as it passes, which is not too much. I think you could survive that, especially since it's a sort of a uniform stretching. It doesn't happen very long. But to compare, I mean, if you placed LIGO at that distance, the arm length would change by 12 meters, a huge amount. But of course, the wave amplitude decays like 1 over the distance. And so if you place this thing in the Virgo cluster, which is perhaps the most hopeful place where we could look for black holes, corresponds to an arm length change of about 3 times 10 to the minus 18 meters, which seems absurdly low, but astonishingly, this is really in the ballpark of what LIGO is trying to measure. I mean, it really is an amazing experiment that they actually even had the audacity to think that they could measure such small changes, but they actually are quite close to this sensitivity now. And one thing that's just that I find quite striking with this is, so if we take the conservative estimate that 5% of the rest mass of the system was radiated, so the total rest mass here is 20 solar masses. So essentially, one entire sun mass was converted to energy in terms of the gravitational wave and radiated out in less than a second. And yet so much energy just caused such a tiny little distortion in space-time. So what it's telling you is you need a tremendous amount of energy to bend space-time. So to summarize, I'll just say just a couple of things about, I mean, what would these simulations be useful in terms of physics? And like I said, the problem is that they take such a long time to run. And if you think, because of the way that the problems scale in 3D, if you want more accurate results, it's sort of impractical. So I'm limited to looking at things where it's perhaps 1 to 2 orbital time scales merge or ring down. So we're not going to be able to produce like 10 libraries of templates for LIGO, but I think this may be useful in the near term, say the next year, to be able to study some very broad qualitative features of the last stages of a binary merger. For example, I think what would be very useful is to pick things like slightly different mass ratios, different eccentricities, different spins for the initial black holes, and just see qualitatively how things differ. Because the expectation is from these perturbative studies, for example, if you have a non-trivial mass ratio, so one might be twice as heavy as the other one, for example, there's some expectation that the final black hole would actually be given a kick, so that the momentum radiated is not going to be symmetric. And there's some thoughts that this kick might be large enough to kick a black hole out of a galaxy. So that will be very interesting to look at. For example, something else that we might be able to look at is when the black holes have individual spins, there's going to be sort of coupling between the spins and the orbital angular momentum. And at least from perturbative calculations, the suggestion is that this coupling could be so strong that, for example, the black holes could actually flip their spins several times before they merge, and there'll be precession of the orbital plane, and that could make for very interesting and complicated orbits. So that's something where, if we start looking at some carefully chosen initial data parameters, we can start scoping things like that out and actually get some kind of idea for what the general features of binary mergers are. So I'll end there. Thank you.
Take to get you interested in simulating the ultra-relativistic case?
So like like head-on collisions near the speed of light, or something like that, or right, some impact parameter. I'd be very interested to do that. The thing that I'm finding with the scalar field initial data is I can't get boost parameters more than about 0.3 or 0.4. So at least at this stage, I don't have the initial data. I think that I have to use some slightly more sophisticated techniques, probably starting with black holes, perhaps superimposing boosted black holes. But that is actually something that I've been interested in. Especially, so Matt Choptik was, I was talking to him about this a few months ago, and he was saying that at least there is some people think that, you know, in this black hole scattering process, that a third black hole might be created. That,
you mean a third separate?
Yeah, so if they don't actually merge, if they just scatter, that there is, that there's at least, I don't think there's any reason to expect that it might not be, or there's no proof that it might not be. But who knows? I mean, that sounded completely wild and out there, but at least he was thinking that there wasn't a, that might be something interesting to look at. So I think it would be a very interesting problem to look at.
It's and classic. I will. You get a classic.
Yeah.
So, like, what, focusing on radiation?
Yeah, presumably. So, I don't know. It sounds very bizarre, but it would be interesting to look at things like that. And so that's also something that I'm thinking of, perhaps within the next year, to try to start getting the. But that's going to have to. I'm going to have to improve my initial data. I can't get very high initial boosts, but.
People talk about these blended excision regions. Do you just chop off?
Excuse me, the.
How do you do the excision?
Sorry, what did you say before that?
Do you just chop it off, or is it some blended intermediate region or something?
Yeah, so at the excision surface, or a grid point that's on the excision surface, I solve the equations there, but all the centered finite difference stencils, or replace them with one-sided difference stencils. I don't know if it's technically called upwinding or not, but it's that. There's no transition zone, so I solve the equations all the way up to the excision surface, but just at the excision surface, I change the finite difference stencils, so they don't refer to anything that's inside the excised region.
Thank you.